Good morning, everyone. Thank you for attending our workshop. My name is Kira Ortega. I am a science educator. I work at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And I have been working with my colleagues from Chibok, Alaska for the past 5 years. Lillian Olson and Lisa Onen are here, and do you want to introduce yourself?
We atka panik angayukagma atis kagan nga panik mong anakadaka su Francis and Mary Pingayak tvame tuchtonga. My name is Lillian Olson, and I have a given native name given to me by my parents, Francis and Mary Pingayak. Panik is has a name that refers to daughter. And I was born in the village of Chibok, so I wasn't born in a hospital. So our village is small.
Waka, we chuchtun, machumak, kasadun atka, Lisa Unin, chupwakame munga. Angayokaka, John and Rita Unin. Hello, my name is Lisa Unin from Chibok. My parents' names are John and Rita Unin. My Chupik name is Machumak. I work at the school district as a Chupik immersion teacher for first graders. And I've been working with the school district for like 20 plus years.
We'd like to acknowledge the support of the National Science Foundation, who funded this workshop, as well as the University of Alaska, Anchorage, and the Chibok School, the Kashinomiut District in Chibok, Alaska. I'm sorry, I don't have a microphone. You really are going to have to tell us if you can hear us so that I can use my teacher voice and project. I don't have an effort right now. But just tell me or tell us if you cannot hear us by going. Our colleague Flora Yuluk was the fourth presenter, but she couldn't be here. She says hello, and she messaged that she could share her story with you. But Flora is Nakuchin Ayuluk is an immersion teacher as well. And right now, what grade is Flora doing?
First grade.
First grade. These are the topics for today's session. There will be two parts. The first part will be the sharing of the story that we have co-created for a number of years, and even before I came into the picture. And it's a story of the Chupik immersion wing in Chibok, Alaska, the ways in which we integrate Chupik STEAM into the immersion wing curriculum. So notice that this is not STEAM from the Western perspective, which we consider hegemonic and potentially really damaging, but rather a position that we take that STEAM is already present in the ways of knowing, in the building of the kayaks, in the fishnets, in knowing the geography and the weather of the region, so that it can be taught perfectly from the Chupik perspective. The second part of the session will be interactive. We would like to inspire you to discuss how the information that we share during the session today informs your perspective, whether you are a K-12 teacher or you're working at the university setting, whether you're a linguist or a science educator, whatever angle you're taking coming into this work and into this conference, we will give you 3 questions for discussion. You can concentrate on 1 question in your group, or you can try to go through all 3 questions, is your choice. So the first thing we would like to share with you is the history of the Chupik immersion wing. So Lisa, do you want to do that? I mean, or Lillian, do you want to do that?
So the history of the immersion wing started like 10 years ago with, you know, the wishes of the community wanting to retain our language. It was not being taught, and we were losing speakers. In our right now, our community is 1,000 people. Currently, there's like 400 speakers, and our elders are really dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
So it started out with a survey, because enough community members had gone to the local school board, wanting to, you know, teach the Chupik language in the school. So that survey went to every single household in the village, and from that survey, the school board, you know, received that there was an overwhelming majority of people wanting to have our language taught in the school. So that was the beginning of our the immersion wing. And at that time, we had 3 of our own local elementary certified teachers who were started the, and they started with kindergarten, first, second. So it was, at one point we added second grade, but we lost some staff due to, you know, some things, mandated, administrative mandated things that, so that's the begin. That's how our immersion wing started.
There are how many students in the immersion wing right now?
Currently we have 60 immersion kids. The younger ones are kindergarten, first, and then second and third. The third classroom is a combination of 2 and 3.
We also have a Head Start, pre-K Head Start, and it's all in Chupik. So the many of the children who are in the Head Start program, the Chupik Head Start program, then enter the immersion wing.
So our...
Wow, somehow the picture disappeared. But I will try to recreate it for you. So that's very strange. Wow,
mm-hmm.
Our pictures are not showing. This is problematic, because they were there this morning. So the idea, so let's talk about the philosophy behind what we're doing, our work, which is actually documenting the curriculum that has existed for 10 years or more in oral form. It was the teachings of Elder, can you say his name?
Aichailmuk.
David Boyskow, who's now 90 years old, and every time I visit Chivak, which happens about 4 times a year, he is there at the school every day for the kids. So he talked about 2 rivers of knowledge. So the 2 rivers of knowledge are the Chupik and the Western, and they're both equally important. The goal of education for the Chupik children should be that they are bilingual and bicultural, really strong, and able to make decisions and seamlessly navigate to both the world and the culture of the village, but that they can also be successful if they decide to go outside the village. So for him, it was really important that the Chupik knowledge and culture and understanding of place were represented in the school. So that was what started this whole philosophy of how education takes place in the school. I am really puzzled by this, I'm sorry. The other idea, and I don't know how many of you have seen this picture that's not there, but it's this idea that instead of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, we embed in it the art, and that when we teach curriculum in places where the language, the culture, and the place are endangered, that we think about curriculum integration. And what's strong in that curriculum is the knowledge, the ancestral knowledge of the people of that village. And so it is holistic, it is integrated, it is not taught as separate silos of knowledge. And that's really important. You see it enacted in the Chupik immersion wing, where everything that's taught is related to what's happening in the village. All the teachers in the immersion wing practice subsistence. So they walk the talk and they have a lot of credibility. They're all fluent Chupik speakers, and that is really important. So it is this idea, as I was saying before, of, oh yes, I know, thank you so much, because I have tons of pictures.
Thank me after it works.
Vanish. Yeah, should we pause for a second?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I see the pictures. Oh, I see all the ones.
Okay.
Did you load it over from another computer to this one?
Oh, is that what's going on? Yeah,
computer.
So,
oh, there are
the
pictures.
Computer,
you
yeah.
can see them. Yes, right there.
Okay, so what I'm thinking is if you try taking making a PDF document out of it, maybe they're showing up. Oops, close the remote. Where did it fall?
And there's my email.
Yeah. Make it disappear.
For everyone to see.
Oh, wait.
Yes.
Okay, so was it desktop? Sorry, I closed it. Right.
It's on the desktop, I suppose.
What's it called?
No, it's on the ICLDC. We can use the search or more
or
recent. Represented in the classroom because they're important for the purpose of maintaining the culture and the identity, a strong identity of the Chupik children. And then the second figure that I wanted to use, what guides the philosophy behind what we're trying to do here, is taking the stance that, and I'm using the diagram from Yachman, 2010, that knowledge should not be separate in the K-12 settings into silos of distinct knowledge, because when we go outside the classroom, knowledge occurs integrated. And in a student-centered classroom, it's really important to represent the knowledge in the way that is occurring on the outside for purposes of relevance, for purposes of acknowledging the complexity of the environment in which the students spend most of their lives. So it's a more holistic approach, and because art is such a strong component of the life in Chivak, the art should be represented there. So instead of STEM, which is what we see pushing by many corporations and the Department of Education and whatnot, it should be STEAM. And in that, the component of the songs, the yurak, the dances, and all of the masks should be represented. And that's an important part of the curriculum. So that's why we talk about STEAM and we say it's already there. It's not to be used as a lens of deficit in which we should try to evaluate or define what happens in the school. So
it was important because as we all age, the curriculum and the lessons existed in oral form because there's a very strong oral tradition in the Chupik culture. The teachers were concerned, and when I traveled to Chivac and I asked how can we collaborate, they said definitely we need a curriculum map and we need to start adding lessons that would be taught with increasing complexity from K through fourth in the immersion wing. We are shorting teachers, that's why it's K second right now, but it used to be at 1.34. And so this is how it all started. Notice that at the center of this curriculum map sketch, there's who am I as a Chupik child. So this curriculum is deeply centered in identity as a Chupik child, first and foremost, as part of the community and connections. And then we have four quadrants, and I do have to say these quadrants reflect the school calendar, the Western school calendar. The truth is that in the Chupik culture, there are many more seasons, and that these seasons are dictated by the beginning and the end of many of the subsistence activities. But we're using, of course, the fall and winter and spring and summer calendar because we do operate within the Western calendar of the school. So that was the beginning of it, and everybody just wrote what was important to know, plants and animals, poisonous plants, and plants that you can eat, for instance, and activities. And then it began growing, and the curriculum director at the school added some more themes to this. So science, astronomy, science, biology, mathematics. You wanna maybe talk about some of the, for instance, in the summer, the kinds of things that you teach in the immersion wing?
Mm-hmm. Okay, like she mentioned just previously, our culture is based on subsistence and we practice it pretty much in families. Still move out into the tundra to engage in many subsistence activities. Just the summer, for example, we have families moving out as soon as school is out. Some families are out there. They go out there to fish for salmon, which they use for food. You know, at camp, they eat the traditional foods, the plants from the tundra, from the ponds and lakes, and then the fish from the rivers. And pretty much the families, you know, engage in like steam activities, even though it's already there, you know, they get to count salmon. We have, you know, they do count, you know, do some math with every day as they catch the fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the lifestyle we live is, you know, we go out there season by season, we move from one activity to some other activity. As you know, the summer ends, we'll move on to like the berries. So we have all this knowledge, names for the berries and things like that, and then we just move from
mm-hmm.
activity to activity. So our culture is very pretty much based on our subsistence lifestyle,
and that's what's represented in the themes in the calendar that you see here. So today we're going to share not only some of the activities in the calendar, but also three distinct projects through which the knowledge and the culture are preserved, and also the Chupik language. So the first project is e-books, the second one has to do with mouse food, and the third one looks at fish traps, the unit on fish. So here's the e-books. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our culture, in our culture we have stories that our elders have that are passed on from generation to generation. a lot of the stories were never written, so, you know, or preservation, you know, or it's those stories are handed down orally. And then in the recent times, what we were able to do was through the use of technology and e-books, specifically e-books, we took some stories and in a classroom, you know, the students get to work in creation of these e-books. They participate. And for example, this story is about Dunu Jisikshu Ilniluni Glukkat Agu Litni Agu Litnu Adam Aghanam Tui Vakalugu Dunu Jisik Wukkit Agu Litni Aghanam Nasikshugu Dunu Jisik So that's a story that, you know, that's passed on, but it was never really written. So in our class, we have, you know, children to do hands-on creation of dioramas, everything, the grass we picked up from the tundra, and since the grass, you know, we use photography, the kids' drawings and everything to create this story, and recorded the language into, you know, this e-book, and it became a story. It's, you know, our language put into, there's another scene here, you know, everything is, all the art is done by the students, and they do hands-on. They make the sewing, they sew, they draw, they create the, you know, the background for the photography using just, you know, our tundra, our land from out there. We had brought in big pieces of tundra and created these scenes. So the kids engage in hands-on while they create a book, and then at the end, there we have a team of our Chupik speakers working on the finalizing the title of the story, because these oral stories passed on really didn't have a, like, the title, but we know the stories about the lady and the loon. So our team of Chupik speakers get together to finalize, you know, just last minute words and Chupik words, the right word to use. So the Chupik words are important to us, and, you know, so we have a team doing that, deciding on the best words to use for the book and title, and transcribing the story from spoken Chupik to written, and whatever else, you know, that's all involved in creation of making an e-book using the language.
So as you can see, the use of technology is really helping with revitalizing the language in the schools. What's happening in Chivak, as in many other settings, is that this generation speaks a language, but the next generation, meaning the parents of the children who are now attending schools, do not speak the language. And the language is going back to the homes because the children in the Chupik immersion wing and in Head Start are taking the language back to their parents. So that's really important. So here's more evidence of STEAM in Chupik ways of knowing and science. And this particular one has to do with a lesson on mouse food, learning about the tundra, and Lisa is going to talk about that.
I'm going to say a little background of when I was younger. During the month of September, October, my mom used to take me out and find certain areas to find mouse food. She didn't explain. She didn't tell me step by step what to do or why it was done. It was, to her, it was like gather food and then just bring home. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand that part. So as I, when I first started working for the school, that's when I had more knowledge and understanding that, as a child, a child is not gonna know just by looking or hearing. They have to learn more with doing hands-on activities. And along with the hands-on activities, I teach singing in class. I include that too. We go out to the tundra. Oops. I let the students collect mouse food on the tundra, and when we take them back to the classroom, this is what we do. The children alert. They distribute. They categorize because there's different types of mouse food. One's a raindrop. The other is magasak, because they know out on the tundra, all that grass that they see have certain names, and the mouse that collect the seeds, they become the plants. These seeds right here, after collecting mud on the tundra into the classroom, we put seeds, and I ask the students to record what's going to happen after. So they're going to see over the days, they're going to see the growth, what's happened to the seed. The field trips the children and I do, they love the outdoors. And that's when learning is much more, because they're using their feelings on the tundra. So there's a lot of things that we can do bringing our culture into the classroom. There's a lot of things. One time I heard an elder say, you have to know who you are, where you're from, and where you're going. And I thought that was really important for me. Thank you.
So you can see that there's an integration of the knowledge about the tundra with the unit in berry picking, that the children are reading stories in Chupik, that the instruction is taking place in their language, and that's very important. In Chivak, the walls of the classroom disappear, because every so often you see a rainbow or a swan comes in and lands on the water. And at that point, the teacher and the students are looking at this phenomenon and then weaving it into what constitutes the knowledge in the classroom. So that's fascinating to see. So for instance, weather and the water cycle are taught at every single grade level because they are important. So how to survive when you know, you're stranded out in the snow, and what is insulation, and how can you protect yourself, and what are the clues that let you know that a snowstorm is coming, and just understanding weather, and then if you are out there in the ice, when is it safe to walk on the ice, when is it not safe? So the knowledge is integrated with the activities of the village and activities in which the children participate. We also, well, they also use technology, for instance, a virtual field trip. In the unit about marine mammals, they use the virtual field trips and kits that are available through the Seward Marine Center. And that is one of the sessions with an expert from the center. Another very important component of what happens in the classroom is that elders regularly come into the classroom and share the stories. And when this happens, the children just greet the elder and all surround the elder, sit down and just listen to the stories about the Uruguay and how it is important to take care of these caterpillars, right? And what can you tell from the shape of the grass and things like that. So that's very important, and it constitutes part of that knowledge that is passed on from one generation to the next. So here is an elder sharing a story, and then here's a sample of the writing from the students. Yet another sample of how STEAM is integrated into the curriculum through the knowledge and the techniques that the ancestors use is this is part of the fish unit, and you can see here a traditional fish trap that is made out of wood, and then over here is a modern fish trap, which was actually made by the students in the 8th grade, and as you can see, it is made out of chicken wire. So the students learn about what places in around the village do you go and place a fish trap, and in exactly what position. They learn about currents and the relationship of the current and the location or the placement of the fish trap. And here's math integration, because they actually learn about cones and cylinders and circles, but that's integrated with how do you build a fish trap. So as you can see, it's knowledge that's integrated to the culture, and it's very meaningful to the children because they see it in the community, they use it, they understand it. So there's a high level of relevance to what is being taught. Part of that learning about fish and fish traps is, and this is quite impressive, so compared to fish anatomy, that's kind of like a high school anatomy and physiology lesson, right? Or a comparative zoology lesson in college, but it is happening in second and third grade. I was there, and it was fascinating. It's completely hands-on, and as they were dissecting, they were learning about the anatomy, but all of a sudden, pull the egg sac, and let's estimate how many eggs there are here. And so there were several guesses, and then it was fact-checking with, this is how many eggs there actually are, approximately, in that egg sac. So there isn't this separation of, now we're going to do math, and now we're going to do biology. It is all part of the knowledge that has been passed down from one generation to the next, and it's right there at a very early age. And then after that, the kids wash their hands, the teacher packed the fish, and that was dinner. There is no waste here, because they don't grow beans just for the sake of growing beans. They grow mouse food to understand about plant biology and identification and germination and whatnot. In that same fish unit, they learn about mapping and the importance of place, and then the stories about not getting lost and finding your way and taking only what you need is integrated in understanding mapping and the areas where you place your fish trap or find your fish. Here you can see another example of what's taught in the classroom. Bird migration and nesting. So Chivac is actually located in a national sanctuary, and there are hundreds of species of birds that migrate all the way from South America to Chivac in the summer to nest because there are no predators there. So the children go with their parents and their relatives, and they go egg hunting. And there's math in that lesson. So that's brought back to the classroom, and it constitutes let's learn, let's count, part of the curriculum, and really relevant and connected to culture. If you walk through the immersion wing, you'll see something like this. There's lots of art. So this is the story of a crane, and as you can see, not only is it the students' work is displayed, but the crane is talking, and all the talking is the writing that's done in Chubik. So what we see through the work in Chivak, in the language immersion wing, is that seeing in Alaska represents lots of possibilities. Instead of a hegemonic lens, we're looking at it as a means to seeing as a means to validate ancestral knowledge, a lens to empower Alaskan Native cultures, a vehicle to foster bilingual and bicultural students, like Elder Wistow really supported in what started the whole immersion wing, an approach to encourage students to enter STEAM fields and take charge of Alaska's future and the preservation of the culture and the language in the traditional ways, and an integral part of K-22 curriculum, because this approach then is taking, I teach science methods courses, and we talk about the importance of culture. And if you are a teacher who's thinking about going to rural Alaska, it is important for you to take into account these two rivers of knowledge, and they need to be equally represented, and you ought to connect the knowledge from the home into the knowledge that you are imparting in the classroom, and it should be student-centered and connected to their culture. So now, it's your turn. We have some samples that we would like to share with you. And for that, I'm going to ask, I know that the room is not tables but that you can sit around, but we're gonna have to work in groups. So I'm gonna ask you to please find, maybe turn around and find a group with maybe two or three other people, that would be great. So if you're sitting by yourself, we really encourage you to find some people and see how many people do we have here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Anywhere in 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. So maybe groups of four, we'll have four groups of four. And so you have choices. You can do all of this, or you can just concentrate on one question. So here are your choices, depending on, you know, your background. You can outline a curriculum map. That's kind of an ambitious project, because it took us all summer at NetBoard. But outline a curriculum map that aligns with your cultural knowledge system about nature. Design a curriculum map, will then engage in one lesson, right? Think of STEAM lessons that can be included in your curriculum. And then, so I discuss this third question. Can technology in the classroom support language, culture, and sense of place in your village, city, or school, whether it's kindergarten or a PhD program? Okay, and then we'll circulate and answer questions that you may have right now. Yes? And then after you have time to discuss this in your groups, we're going to ask you to share with everyone else. All right. Any questions before we start? Okay. We also gave you some index cards if you wanted to take notes. Do they have index cards?
Yeah.
So you want to do 20 minutes of discussion?
Yeah.
Good thing that teacher started working.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, I think you could have just contact others if you didn't feel they're working on that.
Yeah, but then it wasn't giving us a percent review. We asked it to give us a percent review, then there was no signal.
Yeah. Okay.
But thank God you got the technology person to help us.
Yeah, I think you're happy because I don't know anywhere.
Okay, I've never seen it.
Yeah, that's happened in the before too. Where the picture just disappears.
Yeah.
Or like sometimes you open it and just like it's always a power part in particular. You like open it and then the text box has been rearranged.
Yes,
something.
Oh yeah, that happens to me every week.
Like
yeah, work, like there's a series of articles and then it's all
Or I'll like make say also I'll like re put it back and save it and then once you close and do it, it does it again.
Or if you have a format, like if the professor has a format for the PowerPoint and then the student sends a different format, it all merges it into one format and then one on two. But it was so much more nicer, very excited to
you. I know. That's why I prefer with PowerPoints, I always make a PDF.
Yes.
So what do you do when you're not in Chibok?
I'm not in Chibok, I'm at the university. We actually have a grant that's ending this year, actually in December. We do professional development for in-service teachers, so the teachers are already in the classroom. It's a culturally sustaining ESL teacher. So that's what teachers are working on. Understanding of culture, how do you receive the knowledge, how do you use that knowledge, how do you understand second or third language learner as they go through the different places, how do you support them, how do you teach the language learners who you might be speaking and listening at the same time that you're teaching the curriculum. So I teach a number of classes. So associated with this knowledge, I teach culture, language, and literacy. In the spring, after section of that class. Then in the summer, I did an intensive of how you teach ELLs in the different kinds of areas. And the teachers examine the curriculum and the practices, and they work on a curriculum project, and they come together from all over Alaska, and then they share their projects and give each other feedback. So there's 5 days of intensive, and they continue to work on that throughout the summer. And then in the, plus they're taking other classes, I think, 2 graduate courses, I think, one of those courses in this class. And then in the summer, in the fall, I teach two other classes, STEAM methods for graduate school methods associated with that. But I also teach undergraduate students. So that's right. I'm part of the student success committee. This one job of being faculty, but it is divided into the service and teaching and research. And then I go to conferences and write proposals, write grants, and then get funded.
Yeah.
Hey, are you looking at your
future? I know. Hopefully, we'll see. If I can expand to an adult. It's really, well, yeah, I would ideally. It's filling my space with thoughts and jobs that are competitive, especially like the STEM fields I work in. Like, there's more jobs in things like computational linguistics or like applied linguistics, you know, so for what I do, language documentation, there's some jobs, and it's getting bigger now, the field's growing, but even still, like, other things I'm interested in, like, historical linguistics is not really jobs, and a lot of things, the languages I work on isn't the focus of a lot of the departments at all, like, some in Australia, because they live by Papua New Guinea, they're interested in people working on those languages, but in the United States, it's more working on American languages, and so there's not as many jobs for people working on languages. So we'll see. Wait.
The thing about it, you never know where the work is going to take you, because I had no idea when I finished my PhD that I would be working remote in Alaska. In rural Alaska, the teachers are curriculum slow. My PhD is in science education slash curriculum.
Yeah.
But you just go to the opportunity.
Yeah, I guess so.
And you have to be passionate about what you do and really love it, and you know, be able to navigate through the hairball, which is the academia, without being something to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what brought you to Alaska?
The job was there.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to stay in Arizona. So I didn't do this class. And the University of Arizona, I didn't want to it's really the colleagues that were there, the opportunities, like I said, they wanted to teach us the teachers who actually work in Alaska. So it clicked, and it was like, oh, Alaska, oh my God. And I went. You just have to be open to whatever opportunities. I did say, when I graduate, I want to be close to the water.
Yeah.
The water's frozen, but it's
still there.
Who cares? I mean, and I get to come home.
Yeah.
I graduated in 2011, but I taught for like 3 years before I decided to go back.
Are they
I have a
there's not
kind of
Your presence today in your bathroom, I am always promised. I can't keep you just together.
Some of them can be pretty big. Some of them can only put them, you cannot put them, yes, and you eat them.
No, I
do we have a car? Go to the place.
got sexy.
I'm not
trained.
Yes.
I have teeth too.
I don't. My fantasy would come to life. Dreamed about her for 40 years. Everything we got to see back.
Right here.
I'm talking to Teresa.
What?
Never mind. I won't go there.
Can I walk to the
bus? You don't have to go in the lobby. You just sit there. Part of that money is for. They have just $35 in this pure sailing. But we wanted to do both. Vera kind of doesn't want to go in the water either. I'm not sure. Have you ever seen the fish in the water? Have you ever?
Never clear.
Well, there you go. This is it.
Yeah.
This is the time.
See in a minute. Books.
You can go in the water and come right out if you want, but just get in the water.
It's warm.
There are a couple of whites, great whites, but don't worry about
them. Yeah, the
great white sharks.
You know,
here,
they have water snowmobiles.
Yeah, so. Oh, yeah, I've seen
those. Yeah, those are good.
That's what Flo and I call them, water snowmobiles.
This afternoon, we might play hooky and go to the North Shore and watch the surfers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tiny little things.
Well, let me call these people.
Yeah, so I teach about physics.
Okay, you're going to do this now, right? You can't change your mind. You're going to pay for it. Right?
Okay.
You're not skipping nothing. You're not skipping nothing.
I meant to turn it off. For my son.
Are you staying on campus or down in Waikiki?
Oh, it's called the Hotel Renews.
Did you go to the beach at all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'd like to go to
the beach. Yeah. When are you leaving?
On Monday night.
Oh, okay. So you could
do
stuff Monday day.
We're going to go visit the immersion.
Oh. Here on Island.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Yeah.
Who knows where that one is? The high school or
it's not just waiting, right?
I don't know where it is, but so we're invited by Polly.
So
I'm really looking forward to that.
Did you go to the Hilo thing before? Before the conference, did you go to Hilo? Some people go to the immersion program in Hilo on the Big Island beforehand. I've never been. They do it every year before the conference. They have like a field trip there and take people around and show them about. Because I think there's a bigger immersion program there. But there's ones on.
Yeah, I don't know which one.
So how far are you in your study?
Halfway done, maybe. I hope. I started off as a master's student. I'm a PhD student. So, I haven't started my dissertation yet. I'm finishing up my requirements before that. A couple more years at least.
Okay, you guys are on tomorrow. Okay. You could. You don't want to go on your skirt. You can get a baby. Value Village.
Okay, I think if you're ready, we can start.
You
so
have
why don't we start
serious
on
this
group swimming over here?
Do you want to
or do you need more time?
Swimming in.
So
you're not skipping nothing, I'm telling you. You're not. I don't hear that crap. You're good,
okay.
Right?
Well, I really appreciated the presentation. I work with Thingit language an elementary school context, but I'm also a substitute, so I go into some high school classrooms, and the classroom that I'm in, I think some of you know, had a chance to meet Nakasan Hans Chester, but he's here, he's a teacher from K through 5, and he does language groups, like 30 minutes to 45 minutes with small groups of students. And one thing he's been working on is creating a curriculum of paper clan houses that the students can make. And so I really liked that diorama with the ebooks, because then they could use those buildings and maybe like dolls or drawings to make books and mm-hmm. include that language in it. So,
Okay,
well, that was really quick. Okay, maybe
we'll put a lunch earlier.
Move
in the back.
So my name is Lane Schwartz. I'm a linguistics professor at the University of Illinois, but I used to live in Alaska for 10 years. I started school, kindergarten and first and second grade in Gamble on St. Lawrence Island. I've kind of been trying to bring all of that together. And part of my research is exactly this idea of how do you bring technology into the classroom and how can you use that to help enable language vitality and language documentation and revitalization efforts. With St. Lawrence Island UPIC, there's a lot of materials that have been developed over, especially in the 80s and 90s, there was a strong push to both translate and write down stories. And one of the things that I'm looking at that we've been discussing is, are there ways that we can digitize some of that material in a way that makes it more accessible? One of the issues that I've heard from some of the people in Gamble working on the language is that the writing system doesn't make complete sense to the kids today, that there are certain places where it's written one way but it's pronounced a different way. And so one thing that I've been working on and we talked about is a system of automatically rewriting it into the way it's pronounced and giving tools like that to classrooms so that students who are in kindergarten and first and second grade who are just learning, the teacher would have the option of presenting this material that was developed in a more transparent orthography if that's what would be helpful at the time. And just generally speaking, the ideas like with the ebooks, recording some of these stories, I loved what you talked about having the kids create the art that goes into that, because there's a lot of materials that are already in UPIC that could be done, that have already been written down, that could easily be adapted with that sort of thing and have community members do recordings of the stories that have been written down so that you've got not just the audio, not just the text, but also the audio. And then for a lot of this, there's also English translations of it so that you can have all of that to build on each other.
Thank you. Any other comments from the group?
We also discussed other languages and how this could apply, because the tools, and I think that's true of everything that you presented as well, that's why we're all in our groups, the tools really are very applicable.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Emmanuel. I come from Cameroon. Cameroon is located in Central Africa. I teach at the University of Yaoundé, or Yaoundé is the capital. At the institute, we train teachers of high school. So we train teachers to go in the Cameroon languages in, you know, government-based schools, which is great. But the problem, according to me, is, exactly the type of curricula that we deliver. Because the way it is framed is that we are trying to just take English teaching, German teaching, Spanish teaching models and applying them to our languages. Mm. The issue is we are trying to revitalize these languages because in the cities where, of course, you have that issue of moving from rural areas to cities,
mm-hmm.
which is very common in most parts of the world. So this is where language endangerment is very critical. So it's helping me, like my own kids, in spite of the fact that I'm a language activist, they don't really speak my language because my wife is from another speech community.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way language is taught is just like, you know, structural way, just teaching them grammar, pronunciation, alphabet, which to me makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we could develop curricula that combine language and cultural practices with mathematics, physics, etc. And I was just explaining to her that one practical example would be maybe teaching the kids how to cook, you know, traditional meals.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a traditional meal, I don't know the name in English, but it's like melon seeds.
Mm.
And we cook like cakes, I don't know, melon seeds cake, let me put it like that. And it's a whole process. It starts by harvesting the melons,
mm-hmm.
then selecting them. There's a whole technology involved in selecting them.
Sorting them.
Yeah, sorting them. And we thought that in the process, maybe you, because there are more technical words involved. And
yeah, it's a francophone.
Yeah,
so
my English is just not good.
You're doing great.
Yeah.
So we were talking about how they select which melon seeds, and they use a process where they put them in water and then put the water in a basket, and the bad seeds float to the top and the good ones sink. So we were talking about how to teach physics using that and teaching about density.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
So, and then he was just starting to tell me about, I was saying, you know, can we find other things that would float and or sink that are used traditionally to determine what to keep and what to throw away. And he was starting to tell me about a method for testing coconuts.
Yeah. So one of the methods that we use to select good coconuts, those that are good for consumption and those that are not, is just, you know, throwing them into water.
Mm-hmm.
Those that will float are not good ones.
Oh.
Yes. Those that are good will sink.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were thinking we could, you know, he could show these methods and then, or show the teachers these methods,
mm-hmm.
and then we could, they could also have the students weigh the coconuts and see, you know, well, these are less dense than the others,
mm-hmm.
and so learn about density.
Yeah, and do the volume by water displacement.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then mass, and then you get the density of the coconut, and then you can determine the difference between. Sorry, I'm geeking out on science.
No, that's
stop.
Great.
Well, yeah, that's really good. You know, in Anchorage, we have people from all over rural Alaska moving into the city. So we have the schools with the highest cultural linguistic diversity in the entire nation. That presents a challenge to teachers how to incorporate all that knowledge. Ask the kids about their village. What are the weather clues? What does this look like in your village? And so, you know, the professional development of teachers who are in settings where there is a high cultural and linguistic diversity is really important. And that's what you were talking about. know, that the language loss is happening in the urban centers because there's a movement of everyone. They can't afford to live in the villages anymore. That's just one factor. The other one is global warming and the sinking of the villages all over Alaska. People are moving into the urban centers. That is our next challenge, and the challenge is sharing this type of approach with urban teachers who now have all of the students coming from all over the place. How do you honor their knowledge? How do you teach in culturally sustaining ways? Yeah? So thank you. Yeah. Yay, the group over here.
Mathematics in various ways. One is you've got to attach the fish skin to the coconut, and so you've got to put in holes around the circumference. The question is, at what angle do you put them? How do you get fractions in there? By if we need 12 holes, then we've got to divide the circumference into 12.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that the neat thing with all of these lessons is ideas that incorporate cultural knowledge is that you can use the what is it called, spiraling curriculum, where the complexity of the lessons increases as the kids get older and go to a next grade level, so you can take an idea and then develop it through. I think that we all went to school and it was the same thing. The water cycle, again? You know, I thought in first grade, now second grade, third grade, but it became increasingly complex, and so that idea that, you know, it's just what are the core themes and then how do you develop them with, you know, in a way that is aligned to the level of maturity and the knowledge that the kids have. Yeah? Well, thank you for ideas. The group in the back?
Sure, we also have a diverse group. And so we talked about a project that I'm starting to initiate this summer coming up with a, I'm funded, hopefully, to develop some curriculum around an archaeological site. A site of a lot of conflict over 20 years around urban development, only engaging indigenous students about their own heritage and culture at this location, but also the predominant non-Aboriginal population around whom there is a great need to work on changing values. And I think that the taking STEM into it in the classroom at various levels provides the opportunity for some of that value change to happen. So, I mean, obviously there's a social studies curriculum component where we can substitute, you know, Greek archaeology for Salish archaeology, which is fine. But I think when we start looking at the kinds of landscapes that are in the area, and looking at biology and geography, kind of lessons that come through that, we start to look at some of the archaeological data, like magnetometry, and getting students to sort of look at mapping out values that came out of that, that kind of research, as part of their math problems, that they can start to then, like all the students, can start to see that place as valued and treasured, not as a site of conflict and predominant negativity, which has associated with it for a lot of non-Aboriginal students and families in the area. Yeah, so, and we want to target grade 4 and grade 7 initially with our plan, and so we kind of think of like, what kind of knowledge is going to bring to that? Of course, the language would be important, the names of the places, the names of the kinds of things that are found at that place, and just learning those and being exposed to them are important. Interpreting the 4,000 years of history that are there is an element of that. And then how to tie that in so it's not just a social studies lesson, but that touches more broadly on the different opportunities that teachers have to connect to those challenges.
I think that one important component when we do this type of work is also I use the approach of it's social cultural theory in science education, tied in with community engagement, like why are we doing this? And a really important part of it is asking the community members, how can we engage? What can we, you know, as educators who are Western, help with whatever it is that you need? And that the engagement and the research that we do, the main function of it is not to move the field, but actually to benefit the participants. So that lens is really important, and because of that, in asking what constitutes important knowledge, we ask, for instance, the members of the band, the two big teachers, the elders, the cultural consultant. That's really important, or else it's really easy to fall into a westernization of the curriculum. That is something that we don't want to do. So that part is very important. I look at myself as a community engaged scholar. All of the projects are driven by the teachers and the members of the community. Never mind me, I just always ask, what can we do next? What would you like help with? So that's very, very important. Any other questions for us or comments? Yes?
I have a comment. This is a little bit different, but I just wanted to make sure everyone here is aware of Firefox. Have you read the Firefox book? I think it's Elliot Wigginton. It's an educational theory book, really, but it's not focused on it. It's applied, but he taught in Appalachia, and he did something very similar to what you're talking about here, not necessarily the STEM angle, but he got the kids, he had the same problems. He had problems with kids not wanting to come to school, a lot of truancy, and he got the kids to start bringing in traditional foods, and the word Firefox comes from a local name for ginseng, which is traditional in those communities, and so it's just a really good resource for everyone if you want to read about using, you know, asking the kids to bring in stuff that's relevant to their lives, and he had learned to use those as teaching tools.
Yeah, fun to knowledge, right? Any other comments or questions? Thank you so much for your vivid discussions, for sharing with the rest of us, for being here, for caring about what happens in the schools where the language, the place, and the culture are threatened. It's been an honor, and thank you, Lillian and Lisa for traveling all the way from Chivac, Alaska. It took you 2 days to get here, but here you are, and you continue the work in the school. So thank you, everyone.